Twilight by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 11. Let me here introduce Mrs. S. A. Rampa. I have offered her the opportunity of saying what she wants to say, and so here it is. It had been suggested that I should make a small contribution toward this, the 15th book. Write a chapter, for instance, and at first the thought gave me quite a shock. No, I would not presume to try for a chapter, but as the author agrees, I will be very happy to make a few comments. This evening, I finished reading the transcript of Chapter 9, which was hot off the typewriter, and I believe Chapter 10 is also completed, but that one I have not yet read, so if I do not hurry, I will be too late for this book. As I was going about my evening duties, such as watering the plants, preparing our supper, and attending to the very small needs of Cleopatra and Tadalinka, my thoughts were dwelling on the material that I had been reading in the pages of Twilight. First of all, I would like to mention that when Lobsang Rampa refers to my wife or Mrs. Rampa, it is still the same creature who's known by other names in previous books. It is still Ma of Living with the Lama, or Mrs. Old Man of Beyond the Tenth, and Ra'ab of Candlelight. It seems appropriate that you should be assured that Lobsang Rampa is a loyal and devoted person, and he's not in the habit of frequently changing his partner, and I hope the same can be said of myself. A note from Blue Friend concerning his wife's name. I have a newspaper clipping from the Toronto Star in January 1981 that remarks on the passing of Lobsang Rampa, and it reads, quote, Rampa died of heart failure in a Calgary hospital Sunday, but his death was kept quiet to avoid publicity, Sarah Rampa, his wife, said in a telephone interview. Unquote. Many things have been said for and against us, just the same as they've criticized the President of the United States of America, who has just, reluctantly, relinquished his position as President. Like President Nixon, we have suffered greatly at the hands of the press, and during the past few days we've been reminded that the critics with the least knowledge have the most to say. Were it not so, these people would be engaged in formulating better conditions instead of trying to break down the best efforts of a few others who are striving to do some good for their fellow men. But criticism is not my purpose tonight. Rather do I desire to make a few comments about the author of this book, Twilight. Dr. Rampa is not the gruff, embittered old man portrayed by some thoughtless persons. Indeed, he is extremely sick, and therefore has enough cause for gruffness and irritability, but he's not horrid and touchy. Instead, he's continually thinking of others, and during the last week I've noticed more closely than ever how great is his compassion towards those who are in distress. Last night, we listened together, as did people around the world, to the tragic announcement of the impending end of a presidency, and Dr. Rampa was so deeply moved by sadness of it all that he spent a more than usually sleepless night. One of the things which causes this extreme sadness was the attitude of the reporters. They did not merely do the job of reporting, but, to repeat expressions used by another listener, they were sprayed with hate. Perhaps I should apologize for the length of my commentary, for it had been intended that this would just be a few lines. There is just one further point, and I want to put it on record now, for it may be the only opportunity I will have that I personally owe my outlook and my whole attitude to life to this man who has sacrificed so much to help us, and especially to help me. Although life is not always easy, one does not mind so much if one can see where one is going. And as we have been told often enough, there is no shortcut to tranquility. From personal experience, I can definitely state that however difficult, however impossible we consider ourselves to be, with a little effort and regular practice, we can overcome many of our problems, making it easier to live with others and, just as important, easier to live with ourselves. In my own case, the teachings and, even more important, the example of Lobsang Rampa has been the greater factor in assisting me to come to terms with myself, resulting, I hope, in my being a somewhat better person. I do not know whether there will be space left in the book for this modest contribution, because it had all been planned before I could arrange my thoughts. However, the writing has been enjoyable, and I wish there had been more space so that I could tell of various incidents depicting the very compassionate side of the nature, the side which is not familiar to everyone, not always recognized, but which, nevertheless, is a very real part of the Lobsang Rampa makeup. Still, there may be another opportunity, who knows? But I know this. In answer to that offensive man in Australia who wrote demanding that I prove something, let me say that, yes, I know without possibility of error that Lobsang Rampa is who he claims to be, and that all his books are true. Well, I had hoped that if we were going to have illustrations, they could have borne the signature of S. M. Rouse, and I also hope that if blocks were made for illustrations, the foregoing paragraphs by Mrs. Rampa could have borne her signature, because there's always some creep ready to say, "Oh, by golly, he wrote it himself." But he didn't. As for this proof business, well, there's no point in trying to prove a thing to anyone, because if a person wants to believe, then he will believe. And if a person doesn't want to believe, then no amount of proof, no amount of proof at all, will convince him. So you make your own choice. But another thing I've been asked is about books. What books should people read? Well, I can't give a whole list of books because I don't have many myself. But two books in particular have greatly impressed me, and I'll give you the titles and the necessary data. The first is The Spaceships of Ezekiel by Joseph M. Blumreich. That's a corgi book, and I can most truly recommend it. The author nearly laughed his head off when his son told him about UFOs, and the author is a NASA scientist, a man well qualified to know about UFOs and all that. He was so amused by his son's stupid belief in such things that he set out to prove that there couldn't be any flying saucers. The more he tried to prove, the more convinced he became that there were such things. And in the end, as a designer, he was able to design the type of spaceship which was written about in the times of Ezekiel. But it is a thoroughly good book and one that I absolutely recommend. So put on your running shoes and rush out to your local bookstore and buy it, and you'll see I'm a good book critic. Another extraordinarily good book is called Timeless Earth. It's written by Peter Colosimo. I believe it was first written in French, but it's been translated into English by Paul Stevenson, and it's published by University Books Incorporated. I am glad they have some incorporation, because they need it for printing books, don't they? This is another book which really will hold your interest. It tells the truth, and it should be in the library of every serious thinking person. And while you're rushing around for the spaceships book, how about picking up Timeless Earth as well? You might find your education has been improved thereby. Hey, I'm being good in this book, aren't I? I'm not just answering your questions, I'm also recommending other authors. But let us get on with some more of your questions and answers. Let me make a confession here. My sight is very poor, so I've been cheating by picking out the letters which are typed, because sometimes people write to me and their handwriting reminds me of the squiggles which would be made by a spider suffering from St. Vitus Dance, who had just crawled out of the inkwell. No doubt many, many questions which would be most interesting have been overlooked because I could not read the writing. Here's a question, though, which doesn't at all follow in the writer's supposition. The young man says, "You say that we are all immortal, however, wouldn't it be logical to say that if we have no end, we would also have no beginning? Wouldn't it make more logical sense to make it go both ways?" No, I don't think so. I don't see that at all. After all, a thing has to begin, otherwise it is not. And once it has begun, why shouldn't it keep on? In theory, you see, if a person could exactly replace all his body cells in precisely the same pattern as the ones he was replacing, then he would go on forever and ever, wouldn't he? A person wears out for the simple reason that the mechanism which replaces cells increasingly has a defective memory, and so the cells which are replaced and the cells which are replacing are somewhat different and grow increasingly different. I, quite bluntly, cannot see any reason why a thing should not start but not end. And anyway, Mr. L, what do you mean by no ending? We go on and on. There is an end to the human body, the physical body, and then we go on into the astral. And in the fullness of time, there is an end to the astral body. In other words, we die quite painlessly in the astral and pass on to another dimension and so on, ad infinitum. Question, is there such a thing as a half or quarter dimensional world? This question has been puzzling me for a long time. No, there is no such thing. You have to have a complete dimension, otherwise you would get interaction. You get a similar state of things on a very, very minor scale when this world and our negative world come in too close proximity. You get people disappearing, such as at the Bermuda Triangle, but these cannot be called half or quarter dimensions. It is just a misfortunate, not unfortunate, happening. Question. Dr. Rampa, why do the press find such sick joy in persecuting you just because you come along with a very special task that needed to be dealt with? Do they not believe that you are perfectly truthful in everything you say and do? You have rights, you know, and they should respect them. Of course, I have done nothing to make the press like me. But I have done nothing to make the press dislike me either. You see, press people come along with a fierce, threatening demand. They demand that one give them an interview and say whatever they, the interviewers, want said. And if the victim doesn't agree, then he's set up for press persecution. Some years ago, I received an offer from a TV station. They wanted me to go on television and tell the truth of the Rampa story. I was perfectly willing to do so because all that I have written and said is the truth. I am who I claim to be, and I can do all that I write about. So there I was, all ready to go on television. But then, to my profound amazement, I found that they did not want truth. Instead, they wanted me to read a prepared statement saying that I was a fake. Well, I wasn't a fake, so I would not read the statement. So I was not permitted to go on television and tell the simple truth. Instead, I was persecuted by the press. I wrote to the press council in England, complaining of all the vicious lies which were written about me, but the press council thought the press should have freedom to write whatever they wanted to write. I also wrote to the governors of the TV station, and they thought that a television producer should be given the freedom to say whatever he wanted to say on television and to require that other people do the same. So it seems to me that the press, the radio, and the TV are a closed shop. Now I'm going to ask you a question. If you were attacked by the press or radio or television, and you knew quite definitely that what they were writing or saying about you was lies, how could you refute those lies? Remember, you can't get published in the press unless they want to publish what you write, and you can't broadcast or appear before the television cameras unless someone wants you to. So there is no way in which you can defend yourself. Someone may say, well, take legal action. Well, yes, fine, but that takes a lot of money, and it cannot be done unless you have a lot of money. I tried to do that against a man in the USA, a man who was pretending that he was publishing my books, or rather, publishing books written by me when they weren't by me at all. He was making use of my name, but I tried to get a lawyer to act for me, and because I lacked the money to pay the fantastic advance he expected, nothing was done. I have had to see people use my name, misuse my name, pretend it to be and all the rest of it, and there is nothing I can do. If I had the money, or if some lawyer would be paid by results, then by golly, I certainly would make a case against a few people, against a young punk, for instance, who pretends he's my bosom friend and that he's selling articles direct from Lobsang Rampa's workshop. As I told you before, I do not have a workshop. I do not make articles anymore, and if people pretend they are my friend and that they can use my name, then remember, there are only two people who are making things designed by me, Mr. Souter in England and Mr. Orlowski in Prince Edward Island, Canada. Question. You talk about a world leader whose body is presently being prepared on the earth, and for the great entity to come and animate it. Do you know where the body is presently living? Could the entity who's going to come and take over the body be the reincarnation of Jesus, Mohammed, or Gautama? Oh, yes. I know precisely where the body is, and I have actually seen the body. But of course, I wouldn't say where he is, or we would find some crummy pressman rushing off and coming back with some fantastic, entirely imaginary article. I definitely know where the body is. No, Jesus, Mohammed, or Gautama are not reincarnations, and they are not coming to take over this particular body. You see, there's a special group of entities who come down to Earth at certain times. I really hesitate to use the terms such as White Brotherhood, because there are so many stupid people who think they will start up a cult called the White Brotherhood or the Dark Donkeys or something else. There are so many sick people nowadays that they seize on anything which they feel might sound plausible. But there is a definite group of entities, and you cannot take a correspondence course with them, and you will not find them associated with any of these crazy cultists on this earth. These entities who come down to this world, and of course also go to other worlds to set an example as teachers. It would be such a waste of time if they had to get born here, when all they have to do would take perhaps a year. So they take over a specially prepared body, and when their task is done, the body disappears in some way which we will not discuss here. Question. You always talk about humans and animals. Are we not animals, too? Yes, of course we are. Not very nice animals either, some of us. But I am merely following what one might term a pattern in referring to humans and animals. It makes it clear that I am referring to one species, human, or another species, say, cat. And as I have been telling you previously, Miss Cleopatra is the most intelligent person I know, whether we are going to consider animal or human. Question. Please tell us how to use a crystal. I would like to see the answer to that one in your next book. Should we make the room pitch dark before we experiment? Should we put the glass in a safe place so that it won't be used for other purposes? Should we use a little imagination in the matter of making something appear, or what? Well, I really thought I had made the matter very clear on how to use a crystal. Now, supposing you do not have a crystal, supposing you use a glass of water instead. Well, you get a new glass, an absolutely plain glass without any pattern on it, without any etching, without any scratches. In fact, a fairly expensive glass which has no flaws so far as you can see. Then you carefully wash it, and when you've rinsed it off of all the soap suds, you fill it with water right up to the top so that you've got a meniscus. The meniscus is that bump which appears when you slightly overfill a glass. The glass, full of water, is now set on a table or somewhere dark, and you make sure that your room is dark or dim. Obviously, you must be able to see the glass. You must be able to see your hands in front of you, but you do not need to be able to see to read the newspaper. I give you that just as a guide. The correct amount of darkness is when colors begin to disappear. Having the right conditions, you breathe deeply a few times and settle yourself so that you are comfortable. There must be no strain, no muscle which is twitching, no nerve which is flapping. And then you gaze in the direction of the glass of water, but you do not gaze actually at it. You look through it with your eyes unfocused. Imagine that you're focusing on infinity. Do you have that clear? You are looking in the direction of the glass, and you are deliberately defocusing your eyes, imagining that you are looking at some invisible spot in space. You just sit there, letting your mind take over, and the first thing you will notice is cloudiness. The water seems to turn milky white, and then, provided you do not jerk or fall off your chair with shock, the milky whiteness dissipates, and then you see pictures. That's all there is to it. You do not have to imagine things. Why should you, when you can see the real things? After you've used your glass, tip out the water, rinse it and dry it, and then you wrap it in a black cloth and use it for nothing else at all. If you are using a crystal, then you do the same in the matter of gazing at it. But after you've used it, you want to wrap it up in a black cloth, because if bright sunlight falls upon it, you'll spoil its power, in much the same way as if you allow sunlight to fall on a film which has been unrolled. The thing will be no good after. Question. I would like to know what you think of gambling. Well, that's easy. I have said that several times in my books. I'm completely opposed to gambling. And although quite frequently people will send me a sweepstake ticket and all that sort of thing, I have never in my life won anything at all, not even a cent. So there. Question. I cannot seem to find out where the zone for cats is in the astral world. How do you go about finding such zones? You have just been taking me to task in a previous question, saying, why do I refer to humans and animals? Because aren't humans animals as well? So now you want to know the zone for animals. So let me say to you, aren't human animals as well? And if humans can go to a zone, why can't four-legged animals? The answer is, they can. Miss Coo-ee and Mrs. Fifi Gray Whiskers are great friends of mine. They're in the astral plane waiting for me. I have another girl cat friend there, and she's called Cindy. And Cindy comes down to this earth in actual physical form to see me and to give me messages. And that's perfectly true. So let me tell you that animals, if they are of sufficient spiritual status, can go to any plane of existence to which humans of the same status can go. In other worlds, you know, animals are not treated as inferior creatures. They're not dumb animals any longer on other worlds. And to a person who's telepathic as I am, there is no such thing as a dumb animal. And while we're talking about animals, does it ever occur to you that the only bad or vicious animals are those who have been made so by humans? Normally, animals are born good and they stay so, unless messed up by humans. So the answer to your question is this. Animals do go to the same zones as humans, and when you pass over, quite definitely, you can be met by an animal you love and who loves you. The last few days here have been very, very hot, unbearably hot, in fact. But now at this moment, the temperature has dropped about 30 degrees and we're having a thunderstorm. And some poor souls are getting married, or probably they are already married. It is a strange custom here in Calgary that when a couple has just been married and they're driving along away from the place of marriage, they can make as much commotion as they can. The bridal car and all the cars attached to that bridal retinue have horns sounding all the time, and the uproar is truly formidable. I can't see any sense in it personally, because how is it going to help a marriage to have blaring horns disturbing everyone? Another thing that puzzles me here in Calgary is the fire department, the police, and the ambulances. They have the loudest sirens I've ever heard anywhere. Not only that, but the ambulance sirens wobble and warble and really could just about scare a nervous patient to death. Where I live, there's a sort of conjunction of concrete buildings, and for some strange reason, the sound echoes and re-echoes and echoes again, and quite truly seems to be increased in volume because of some architectural idiosyncrasy. Anyway, the noise goes on day and night, and here the traffic is unceasing. I have never seen the road outside without loads of cars. Throughout the whole of the 24 hours of the day and night, there's a continuous flow of fast cars, and I often lie in my bed and look out the window and wonder, where are all those people going? Unceasingly moving the whole time, non-stop, day and night. There are too many cars here, and too much noise. But I suppose some will write to me now and say, I'm jealous because I haven't a car, or something. People do that, you know. People write and tell me I am bitter. I didn't know it. I don't feel that I'm bitter. I have my own problems, and I cope with them as best I can. So there it is. When I was in the hospital last time, I had a learner, Christian, chaplain, come and try to con me into a bit of religion. And before I said anything, except that I was a Buddhist, he said, "Oh, and do you feel guilty about it or bitter that you're not a Christian? So what do you think about that?" I could have replied, "No, but you look a bit guilty about being a Christian." It does seem so strange that so many doctors and so many parsons try to cough up a sort of pseudo-psychology. They try to analyze one's behavior entirely on textbook learning, and they forget that a Buddhist may have a different outlook on life than does a Christian. But let's get back to some of these questions and answers. But first of all, let me read you something from a letter written to me by Mr. Borge Langeland. He says, "I am happy to learn that you are writing a 15th book. I don't know how to tell you how much your books have meant to us. If they weren't true, I should lose all confidence in my ability to judge what to accept and what to reject. To you, perhaps your aura work is the most important mission in this life, but I think that by writing your books and letting people in on some of the mysteries of life that some of us have been fumbling about trying to solve, you have done far more good for humanity than by proving that there is an aura and that it can be photographed." Well, Mr. Langeland, yes, you have my definite assurance that all my books are absolutely true. These books are not fiction, they are truth. Not just truth, as I see truth, but actual truth. Yes, the great 13th Dalai Lama did indeed bless me by placing both of his hands on my head in a special manner. In a special manner is important because a very, very gifted man, as was the great 13th, can pass on special powers. He can, in effect, speed up one's vibrations. This, by the way, is an answer to someone who wants to know about such things. You probably know that years ago in England, and in fact in many countries, there was quite a definite belief that the king could cure illness, and if a king placed his hands on a sufferer, then the sufferer would be cured. You get the same thing in the legend about Jesus, where if a person could touch the robe which Jesus wore, then he or she would be cured of all illness. It is because such people have a different vibration, and when they see by their superior knowledge that another person has possibilities for improvement and a possibility for accepting an increase in vibration, they do that necessary gesture, which does give the recipient an ineffable sense of well-being and power. And I'm going to tell you that my abilities increased enormously from that act by the Dalai Lama. You ask why one hand or why two hands? You tell me that people who go to church and get blessed every Sunday don't seem to be any better or any worse because of it. Well, that's right enough. The great 13th used two hands in the same way that if you have an electric device, you have to have two wires, two contacts, because just one would not pass any current. As for your saying that people who go to church are not improved by being touched with one hand or two hands, no, that is just what I've been telling you. You only get benefit if the person doing the touching is a superior person, not some poor parson or cleric who's just doing mumbo-jumbo because it's the easiest sort of job he knows. In any way, he doesn't know anything else. Oh, no. As far as benefit comes from such a thing, you could go out and ask anyone in the street to touch you on the head, and you'd be just as well off. You ask what causes the sun's rays to be reflected so brightly from the moon. We have sent men to the moon, and they've discovered that the moon is not made of green cheese, but of rocks and sands, and very similar to what is here on Earth. When the sun's rays hit a high mountain top on Earth, early in the morning or late at night, the valley below remains in darkness. Since the rocks on the mountain top are similar to the rocks on the moon, why don't they reflect the rays down into the valley? Easy, my dear sir, easy. The surface of the moon is very similar in its reflective power to that of gypsum, and gypsum, which is like plaster of Paris, does indeed reflect. But in the case of the moon, the reflection is aided enormously because there's no air to absorb the light rays. Light rays, you know, consist of vibrations, and if there's enough air, then the vibrations are slowed by passage through that atmosphere. The moon, as we know, has no atmosphere. Thus, the rays from the sun reach the moon unimpeded and are reflected unimpeded from the moon's surface. You ask about rocks on Earth. Why do they not reflect the sun's rays down into the valley? The answer to that is because the angle of incidence is different. You see, when you get rays of light coming down to mountaintops, the rays are reflected upwards or within a narrow arc. They're not reflected downwards, and you can easily try this out for yourself by having a fairly powerful light bulb suspended from the ceiling, and that will represent the sun. Then you sit on the floor with a hand mirror in your hand. You can then reflect the sun's rays, or actually the suspended lamp, back on to the ceiling or fairly high up on the walls around you, but without very acrobatic contortions, you cannot reflect the rays down between your feet, which will be considered as the valley. Is that clear? The third question from this gentleman is a sensible one, so let's answer it. He says, you write that wars are necessary to control the population explosion and to give people an opportunity for self-sacrifice. What is the karmic effect on such war heroes who perhaps give up their own life fighting for their country, but in the process kill or maim many of their enemies that they have never even seen before. When or if they should meet again, somewhere in the hereafter, would they ask, "Are you the SOB who killed me?" And how does someone gain merit for fighting a war and killing someone, even if they lose their own life? The laws of karma are different when a person is fighting in defense of his home, his family, and his country, so that if you are ordered into the forces, you really have no choice. You have to go. And once you are in the forces, you come under a blanket protection so that the people who give the orders, which basically the governments, have to accept the karmic results of those orders. You, Private AB, are sent to the war front. You have a rifle in your hands, and at certain times you may be told to fire that rifle. You have to obey your orders, or you may get killed for disobedience. So you pull the trigger, and a bullet kills one of the enemy. The karmic effect of that is not yours. You do not have to worry about it. The karmic effect is assumed by the person or persons who actually caused the war. When you get to the other side, you do not have to meet the person you killed or the person who killed you. Only if you have no dislike or no hatred of those persons can you meet them. Certainly, you can gain merit by preventing atrocities. Suppose a little troop of men are able to ambush members of the opposition, the enemy, who were setting out to massacre a lot of women and children. Perhaps they were going to set fire to the houses after they had locked the inhabitants inside. Well, you and your small troop could kill, perhaps, 20 members of the assassination gang, but in doing so, you would have saved possibly 2,000 women and children and old people. So the balance would be to the good, wouldn't it? And under that heading, you would have gained merit. Mrs. Nancy Justice is an old friend of mine, and we have been corresponding for, oh, I forget how long, but it's been quite a long time. And now she writes in and she has some questions. So I think we ought to attend to Mrs. Nancy Justice, don't you? She says, "I am slightly clairvoyant. In your book, Wisdom of the Ancients, you define clairvoyance as seeing through walls and beyond. What I mean is knowing what is going to happen before it happens, but I can do this to a limited degree only. I have an urge to crystal gaze or something of that sort. I know mirrors seem to draw my eyes, and I read somewhere of mirrors that were used once upon a time where they painted one side or something. Could you tell me how to do this?" Well, Mrs. Justice, I've just been writing about crystals and how to use them, so I think that actually does answer most of your question, but very definitely I would not advise you to use a black mirror, because if used carelessly, they are a very dangerous thing indeed, and enable mischievous entities to work harm through you. So take my advice and have nothing whatever to do with these black mirrors. A crystal cannot harm you in any way at all. You go on. "I see that you talk a lot about the astral and traveling by astral. Also, I believe you when you say that no harm can come to you. But I am one of those strange persons who is deathly afraid of hypnotism, even self-hypnosis. What I wanted to ask you is it true that when you are deeply engrossed in reading something, like reading a book to the point that you are not aware of outside influence, well, that is a form of hypnosis? No. No harm can happen when you are doing astral travel, unless you are afraid. But then, you can be harmed if you take fright even if you're crossing the road. You might run the wrong way. I am definitely opposed to hypnosis. I'm also opposed to self-hypnosis because it is so easy to do it the wrong way. Easier to do it the wrong way than it is to do it the right way, in fact. So, stay clear of all forms of hypnosis. They are bad. But rest quite assured that when you are reading a book, you are not hypnotized. Instead, you're merely interested, and that is absolutely safe. You give a third question, Mrs. Justice, and it is so applicable that I'm going to answer it all here now. You write, "You keep saying that to try all the different things in your book, that nothing will ever happen to you, like being possessed. Fine, but how did those people who are possessed get that way? What did they do or not do?" That's a fair enough question, but you will remember just above that I've been telling you not to do hypnosis. I've been telling you not to use black mirrors. So if you do and try these things, then you can easily get possessed. I'm telling you throughout all my books how not to get possessed. And if you follow what I write, then you cannot get possessed. But if you disregard what I'm saying, then you will get possessed, which is what you wanted to know about. Black mirrors, black magic, hypnosis, and some of those Ouija boards can lead you astray. You can get hypnotized with them. You can get possessed. And that is why I say, time after time, don't do it. End of chapter 11.